Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's talk, given by Senior Meditation Instructor Kathy Lamo Jackson, is entitled The Mahamudra Lineage Prayer, A Guide to Practice, Talk 5. The view of Mahamudra, that our minds have basic goodness and wisdom, is a vast view. But what should the conduct of a dedicated meditator be? Kathy Lamo shares Trungpa Rinpoche's advice about how a high view doesn't mean a person disengages from the world. Their view prompts them to practice love and compassion for everyone they meet. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to start by saying the Mahamudra lineage prayer in English. So I had asked if people could share the red books together, thank you, with one another. The book we're studying from today is going to be the last chapter of the book, The Mahamudra Lineage Prayer, A Guide to Practice by Kenshin Trungpa Rinpoche. And it's a compilation of many of his teachings over the world. And as probably every class has said before, whenever you go to our monastery at KTD in Woodstock, New York, or any teachings by Kimball Karcher Rinpoche, or any gatherings of Trungpa Rinpoche, he always does this prayer. This is our foundation and our instructions of what to do in, as Buddhists. So let's begin. We're just going to say the English. Great Vajradhara, Talopa, Naropa, and Marpa, Milarepa, Lord of Dharma, Gampopa, knower of the three times omniscient Karmapa, lineage holders of the four great and eight lesser schools, Dri Kung, Tak Lung, Salpa, Glorious Drukpa, and others, you have mastered the profound path of Mahamudra, the Dakpo Kagyu, unrivaled protectors of sentient beings. I pray to you, Kagyu Lamas. Grant your blessing that I may follow your tradition and example. As is taught, detachment is the foot of meditation. Attachment to food and wealth disappears. To the meditator who gives up the ties of this life, grant your blessing that attachment to ownership and honor cease. As is taught, devotion is the head of meditation. The Lama opens the door to the profound oral teachings. To the meditator who always turns to him, grant your blessing that uncontrived devotion be born within. As is taught, unwavering attention is the body of meditation. Whatever arises is the fresh nature of thought. To the meditator who rests there in naturalness, grant your blessing that meditation be free from intellectualization. As is taught, the essence of thought, Dharmakaya, they are nothing whatsoever, and yet they arise. To the meditator who reflects upon the unobstructed play of the mind, grant your blessing that the inseparability of samsara and nirvana be realized. Through all my births, may I not be separated from the perfect Lama and so enjoy the glory of the Dharma. May I completely accomplish the qualities of the path and stages and quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. So before we begin, I always mean to say this. If any of you are brand new and not sure where to go, we have a lovely beginning Buddhism class going on upstairs. What do you know the topic today? The three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So I'm not trying to get rid of you, but I just want to make sure people know that they're invited to go to that anytime. And if later on you decide, well, maybe I should check those out, you can plug in at any point. So I was here a few weeks ago, and we went over chapter 3, but today is the very last chapter, chapter 5 on conduct. But I thought first, I was just curious, hold on, this is my husband's Surface. I have the hardest time opening the back. Yay, it worked. I wondered, did anyone buy the book yet? Oh, great. I'm so happy that you did. Who's that back there? Is that Eric? Eric's hiding. I love that. So I forgot to introduce myself. My name is Kathy Lamo Jackson. So let me log into this baby. Come on, wake up. I have no idea why it's not turning on. So does anyone know how to get a Surface to go? There we are. Wow, there's my stuff. So I thought it would be nice to kind of go over. So this prayer is a collection of stanzas that are all interlinked together. And if you notice at the end of each one, it says, grant your blessing that. So I thought for a moment I would just say what they are. This is a review. It says that I follow your example and hold your lineage. This is the supplication to the entire Karmakagyu lineage. So when you say the first lines, it's Dorje Chang, Talo, Talopa, Naropa, Marpa. These are all different teachers in our past that have kept this lineage alive. So it's honoring them. And also we're asking to be able to follow their example and that we are also lineage holders. The second one is I have no attachment to honor or gain. We're learning detachment. Next is devotion, that the genuine devotion be born within. And the book very beautifully outlines this, that the prayer does, but the prayer, you know, is very, very concise. After devotion is non-distraction. Grant your blessing that meditation be free from conceptualization. This is shamatha. Next is vipassana, realizing that samsara and nirvana are undivided. So I love the intro of the book by His Holiness Karmapa. He summed it up very nicely. The beginning is like intro, preliminaries, and then it gets into what is the Mahamudra practice. So can anyone tell me what Mahamudra is? Briefly? Mahamudra is so vast, but so on the tip of our tongue, you might say. So Mahamudra is, you might say, our goal as Buddhists in the Vajrayana lineage. You know, people think of the word enlightenment, but there are different definitions of enlightenment. So Mahamudra is resting in the true nature of who we are. And they say every given hour we're having a flash, just a moment of realizing our true nature. So this prayer sort of encapsulates the stages to get to that. So first, you have to have a connection with the lineage, devotion. Then you have to look at what you're attached to and start making a commitment. Then start doing shamatha meditation and then doing vipassana meditation. And today we're going to talk about conduct. But just to kind of review, I thought I would do a quick review about the meditation because I thought you might get a little confused about this. So the meditation that we do here on Sunday is called shamatha. Means abiding or in peace or calm abiding. And here, you know, we count the breath and all. That's like I would call stage one. Later on, it changes greatly. And how do you shift? You have a teacher. Lama Kathy can give you instructions on that. Some of the mentors here can do that. So it's important to know that it's very important to have a connection with a teacher. This might not be your ultimate teacher or the teacher you took refuge with, but someone that you have trust. And so today we're going to visit also about the teacher. And if anyone has any questions, I'll have time at the end for Q&A. So in the book, the first line, I really liked it. Highly accomplished practitioners of the past have said again and again, even though your view may become very vast, this is when you start experience this in meditation. Our activity and behavior should be peaceful, tame, and decent. Now, you would think the two go together, but sometimes I would say the two, our behavior and our meditation haven't caught up together and are not yet in fully sync. So how do we do this? We become more mindful of it. And not through heavy judgment, but just something you can work on every day. I always love the stories of Lord Atisha and some of the ones from the great past that would every day review their life. And, you know, in the beginning, they would have a pile of pebbles. One would be the everything I did wrong today and everything I did right. And the right ones would be nothing. And then over time, they started to see their behavior change. Just by doing, I'm kind of going out on a limb saying this, but I think I've heard this in the past. And I think those that meditate would agree with this. By doing meditation, you become much more aware of the inner workings of your mind. We don't sit there and dive and examine, but it's very obvious certain things repeat themselves, or certain things are on our mind, or you become much more aware of what you're saying and doing. And so that's the beauty of meditation. So at this point, we're asking, and Trungpa Rinpoche, he put this in here. Now, this is from the very last stanza, which would be nice if I read. The last stanza reads, "Through all my births, may I not be separated from the perfect Lama and always enjoy the splendor of Dharma, perfecting the qualities of the path and stages. May I swiftly attain the state of Ajadhara, which is the Dharmakaya or the ultimate in Mahamudra." So I thought for a moment we should talk about anyone here, and this is an open discussion for a moment. Does anyone here feel peacefulness when they meditate? Any hands? Thank you. I have older eyes, I have to. Anyone feel that sometimes your temper or what you want to say has been calmed down a bit? You're more observant so that you don't react so quickly? Any hands? For me, that's particularly me. And decent. I thought that was an interesting thing. How are you ethically? Does that wake you up now more and more? You become much more aware of maybe your behavior, how you're affecting people, and how you want to treat people kindly, even though they might not treat you that way. Because certainly in the past, we've treated them that way. So I think that's very important. Does anyone have any questions about the conduct? Okay. So the last chapter was on Vipassana, which is, so there were two practices in this bundle of Mahamudra. One was shamatha, learning how to deal with the so the mind is less distracted. Then we move into Vipassana. Eric, did you teach that class? Okay. I wasn't here, so I wasn't sure. In that practice, usually with the help of a teacher, because this is particularly in this practice, you need a pointing out from a teacher. So going back, Vipassana practice, through the grace and the blessings of our teachers, either you have an interview with them, it might be a room with 1,000 people, and they'll say a line, and due to their incredible skill, a lot of people will be quickly affected and may have a flash moment of realizing their true nature. And we don't dwell on this experience because everyone does it differently. Mine was in a weird interview, and I laughed and cried at the same time. I didn't know I could do that. Everyone has a different how our teachers do it. And it could have been I was just finally ready to hear something good because I have a lot of thick layers. But so, again, going back, our true nature, so this is our type of enlightenment we're going for, something that is always there, we're just not aware of yet. So meditation helps us slowly peel away our distractions, our disturbing emotions, and start seeing who we are and, of course, who everyone else is. And Vipassana particularly works going inward, not outward. The sixth consciousness works a great deal looking and judging the world. But when we meditate, we start looking inward a little bit more. So in the practice of Vipassana, there were two aspects, meditation and post-meditation. I believe most of Eric's chapter was on the meditation. I think it was Marcus, but I wasn't sure. You could just say yes, though. But thank you. So there's two stages to all meditation. Meditation where we sit formally on the cushion. Then there's meditation off the cushion, which for most of us is 99% of the day. So how do we conduct ourselves? And there are guidelines. There's many wonderful texts out there. One of my favorite books to talk about the guidelines of behavior would be The 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva. The Jewel Ornament by Gampopa is a wonderful book. And for me, I can't just sit there and bring everything up. I like to look at something. So I remember years ago, I found this book, also by Trungpa Rinpoche, on the 10 virtuous actions. So instead of focusing all the time on what you've done wrong, maybe think about what you're doing right. So they're broken into body, speech, and mind. So let's see if he has a list here. Yes. So the first one is not to lie, not to take what is not given to you, and avoid sexual misconduct. That has more to do with adultery for married people. These are also vows a lot of us take. So that was the body. The speech is not to deceive, not to slander, and avoid harsh words, and avoid empty speech. And then the mind, avoid avaricious thoughts, not to be malicious, and avoid wrong view. Wrong view that you are better than other people, that this is solid. There's many different types of wrong view. So I think sometimes it's really nice to either go online or find a book that you could review this. And this isn't where he just lists them. Oh, no, no. Let's look at the one on harsh words. He not only defines what that is, he talks about what practices to do to develop precious words. And some of them talk about looking at your mind more and how to deal with that. So this is something that if you can start working on it, I think would be a very nice thing when you walk out of these five classes we've had, not only to work on your practice, connect with the teacher, but become much more mindful of your actions, your thoughts, your words. The words are, I think, the hardest ones. They just spill out of our mouth, and then afterwards we're aware of that. So I thought for a moment we would take apart the four lines. So the first one is, through all my bursts, may I not be separated from the perfect Lama. So I love how Trungpa Rinpoche worded it. He said, we want to practice Dharma, but we're fickle. We're lazy. We lose heart. We're not encouraged sometimes. And sometimes we just don't want to practice. Does anyone fall into that category? Can I ask anyone, what do you do when you don't want to practice?
Practice anyway.
Do it anyway.
Exactly. That's a good answer. So the wonderful thing about having a teacher is, and we're going to talk about a teacher in a moment, the more about how to get one and everything. The wonderful thing about having a teacher is they've given you so many teachings. That's the biggest commitment you can do with a teacher is review their teachings. Don't just go, we have a saying that it's important for a teaching to listen, contemplate, and meditate on it. So it's so important to listen. When you go to a teaching, try and listen. Try and be an open vessel, receptive. We're not always that. Sometimes we have other things on our mind. Sometimes you're jet lagged. But it's nice to be able to listen with a very open heart. Then, if it touches you, you start to contemplate on that. How do you do that? You review it. So most teachings anymore are either they've been videotaped or they're made into books. Or you take really good notes, or try and take good notes. And then you review that, and then you meditate. And the meditation is usually about some type of practice. So it's really important to do those stages. Repeat them all the time. So I'm sure many people here, I'll give an example, is the Bodhisattva vow. Maybe I'll back up. The refuge vow. Most of the people here, how many here have taken refuge? That's a vow you take it when you become a Buddhist. So how many of you review what that means every week? Very nice. Very nice. Sorry?
Every day.
Well, not just repeating the prayer, but I think sometimes it's really important to really contemplate that. I've given the example before in retreat. I was only in retreat for a little while. But in retreat, we were doing Ngundro. And in Ngundro, there's the preliminaries of learning about how precious our life is and impermanence, karma, and samsara, and unsatisfactoriness qualities of samsara. And most people just zip through the prayer and get over to the prostrations. No, no, no. They said, no, no. Each month, you're going to do one of those. And every day for 8 hours a day. Like we would break it up. And I thought, I'll never make it. I thought that was really hard at first. But then I decided instead of me just trying to figure it all out, read some inspiring books. And I was amazed how it really enriched my understanding of the four ordinaries, particularly impermanence. That one really rings a bell with me. So do any of you have a question about this, or any of you find something that helps you? Any tools? We got a quiet group today. Okay. Go ahead, Marilyn.
Anytime I do my prayer in the first part of Mundo, it's retaking the Bodhisattva. And I think about it when I'm done with three repetitions.
Nice.
That's the only way I get ahead of my negative emotions, is to really think about that.
Marilyn has just said that when she takes the refuge vow or the bodhisattva vow in Lundro, during the repetition, you contemplate on that. That's very important. I agree. Thank you. That's a good example. So maybe instead of just coming to the center on Sunday, or maybe every day when you do your meditation, also spend a moment contemplating, why are you doing this? Be inquisitive. Are there any changes? How could I make it better? Do I have any questions? And then go back and meditate again. Okay. So the line again was, through all my births, may I not be separated from the perfect Lama. So first we talk about, because the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, are so precious, and because we're fickle, we sometimes are derailed and forget about it. But going back, our teachers are truly a genuine source of the Dharma. And to try and study and contemplate and meditate on what they gave you. And then Chöngen Rinpoche talked a little bit more about how to choose and rely on a spiritual teacher. And I thought I would read his Q&A on this. Somebody asked a beautiful question, and he put it so eloquently. The question is, Rinpoche, you said that it is necessary to choose a teacher carefully, but it is also said that when the teacher is ready, the teacher will appear. How do we reconcile these two statements? I love the second part. Also, what do we do about the fact that many of the wonderful teachers that we encounter seem to be traveling continually, so it's difficult to maintain a continuous relationship? This is Rinpoche's answer. It's true that some people will meet their teachers, their gurus, as a result of previous karmic connection. But even in those cases, it's still necessary for them to choose and to examine the teacher very carefully. You might also ask yourself right now, well, what do they look at? They look at their behavior, right? Behavior is sort of the first thing we see in one another. Otherwise, they can make the mistake, and even though they might have a karmic connection with that person, maybe this isn't their teacher. Then with regard to the problem of teachers traveling a lot, when we say relying upon a teacher, does not mean that we have to be around them all the time. It means that you have to receive the instructions from them, and then you have to actually practice that instruction. He gave the example of Marpa and Milarepa. These are teachers in the far past. And these are some of our major lineage holders. So Marpa and Milarepa were not really around their teachers for most of their lives. The point is that you have to get instruction and then actually practice it. So in the case of Milarepa, you read the life story of Milarepa, and you think, though he was living where his teacher was, he only was with his teacher for a short amount of time. But he took those teachings. And I see so many people in this room, most of it, we don't live in upstate New York or in India and other places. But those teachings are still alive because they were basically breathed into you. And now you're using them and examining them. So that's what we meant with that. So then moving on. The second line is, and always enjoy the splendor of the Dharma. And Chöngen Rinpoche essentially said, actually practice what you've received. And that's such a simple line, but a very good line. Then the next two lines are perfecting the qualities of the path and stages. May I swiftly attain the state of Ajadara. So perfecting the quality and the path and stages are the short-term results. And may I swiftly attain the state of Ajadara is the ultimate fruition or enlightenment. So Ajadara is the Buddha that you see here. He's the blue Buddha in the lineage prayer. Sorry, the lineage talk, as you see, of the Karmakagyu lineage. He is considered the primordial Buddha. He is considered the nature of our mind. And because we're human and we need color and we need form more than other beings, probably of other dimensions, this works for us. It's very, very beautiful. And there's great symbolism in his body, but we're just going to tap on that a little bit. Then he spoke a little bit about the four stages of Mahamudra. So it's important sometimes in language that you don't mix things up. Mahamudra and Mahayana are sort of sound a little similar. In Mahayana, so we have, you might say, three tiers of Buddhism. There's Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. But Mahayana is the greater vehicle, the one where the Buddha pointed out compassion, how to develop compassion and emptiness. And then Vajrayana is what we practice, which is sort of a combination of all three. Mahamudra is what we talked about earlier, is our awakening, resting in the nature of who we truly are. So they had different way they break it up. And it was, he didn't go into much elaboration, but it was one-pointedness of mind. The second stage was simplicity, to the recognition of the true nature of all phenomena, which is beyond elaboration, so it's very simple. One taste, the point where we have not the slightest attachment, not even the fear of pain. And the last one was non-meditation, where one is no longer, there's no distinction between meditation and post-meditation. And the ultimate fruition or enlightenment is the final stage called Vajradhara. So I thought I would read a section, or not read, but read from it a little bit. It was towards the end of this chapter. I thought, very interesting. I had never thought of this before. He talks about studying and meditating. We study and then meditate, or we have two options, study and meditate, or meditate and study. So I'll read it because it's very well put. If we meditate first and gain some experience in meditation, and then study, for example, entering the middle way, it's a Mahamudra text, we will discover, oh, this is exactly what I experienced in my meditation. This is definitely it. Have any of you had that happen? You'll meditate, and then later you'll read something and go, oh, I've had that happen. So that's one way to do it, one order. By having meditated first, we recognize that we've experienced things by reading the text. The other way of getting about it is to first study, because we've already talked about that, and then go through all the logical reasonings for the existence of emptiness, thus creating an intellectual understanding of the mind, and then later receiving the pointed out instruction. So there's two ways to go about everything, and I thought that was very interesting. Do any of you have a certain way you do it? I tend to do both, because they teach us, and early on they always say, study, contemplate, meditate, but sometimes I like to meditate, just try the meditation, and they go, oh. I was trained not to be too over-intellectual, but to go right for it. Meditation was the most important thing. Kempa Rinpoche always talked about. Do the practice first. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I would get teachings over the years. I've gotten teachings from like Kempa Rinpoche that were like, wee, over my head. And I'm like, I don't think I'm getting this. So then I would just meditate. Just meditate, not even think about what it was, just let my mind go. And I think I open my mind so that answers start coming. You start hearing bits of that teaching coming at you again and again and again, until finally you get it.
I'll never forget, Sitja Rinpoche was at a KTD doing a Mahamudra course, and they forgot to have us learn something, and we had one day to learn the whole practice. It's a really special practice, and it was the end of the whole course. We've been meditating all week, hearing all these words, trying to figure out what to do, and the last session, they told us what to do, and everyone just absorbed it, And I think it's because our minds were just so tamed, so calm, just open. It was just amazing. And we're talking, this was an event with hundreds of people, and some were real characters, and we couldn't believe that even they were tamed down, you know. They were no longer going to the shrine room, you know, in their BBDs doing prostrations. Everybody had kind of evened out and calmed down. And I think it was not only the blessings of all that were there, but because they made us practice. And practicing is really great. Yes, Tim. Maybe you should step over. We should start doing microphone work. I keep forgetting. Why don't you come on over and use a mic? For the sake of the listeners, I apologize. I haven't been doing this.
A few years ago, the Lama from the Dallas KTC was here. I think his name is Lama Dudum Dorje.
Dudum Dorje.
Yeah. And his technique was he would teach, and then for about 5 or 10 minutes, and then he would say, okay, let's meditate on that. And we would stop, and for 2 or 3 minutes, we would just be silent. And I remember not thinking as much about what he had just said, but just kind of letting it sink in somehow. So, mm-hmm. And that was a technique that's responding to your question about study first or meditate first. So,
thank you. That's great.
I like kind of integrating the two.
So do I.
Yeah.
I think if you're learning a deity practice, then you probably would study first so that you would understand. But I have to say, for years, a lot of us did Chenrezig practice before we ever were told what was going on. And it still was very beneficial. And I think sometimes you can overthink it, especially me. So I usually put all my notes away when I do deity practice, sometimes just to have the blessings of that practice. So this was a very, very short chapter. Are there any questions about this prayer? Yes, Tim.
How does the Eightfold Path fit into this conduct?
Can I ask why you're asking that?
Well, because I think it kind of feels like conduct when I read it. How to live my life.
Can you give me some of the Eightfold Path?
Right intention, right action, right speed, right livelihood.
So I think all of the Eightfold Path really ties in with conduct completely. So your question was,
I was encouraging you to talk a little bit about integration.
Well, you know, there's something we haven't talked about today, and that really is karma and our actions. And so everything we do, everything we think has an effect on our karma. Not something to be afraid of, but something to be aware of, that all of this is much more complex than we think it is. They say that not until you reach certain levels of bhumis are you aware of how your actions and your thoughts have affected you and others. So by having right livelihood, let's just use the word virtue. I think virtue, we don't even have to enumerate it. By trying to live a virtuous life, no matter how human we are, of course, we'll probably make mistakes. Living a virtuous life is very important and something to strive at all times. Because, first of all, on a very personal level, it helps you. I know I've said this before, and it's no secret, I have a bit of a temper. My husband can tell you that. I try not to lose it, but sometimes, particularly those we love closest, are hit a little bit by it. And if in any way I say something that's really cutting because I'm upset about something else, I feel the immediate effect of it. I'm a stroke survivor, and I can't get very angry or I start shaking. But on a much bigger cosmic level, I've upset my husband. Then he goes to work, and maybe he hasn't realized that maybe I wasn't feeling well. And then maybe he spreads it out to about 5 other people. And it just keeps spreading out our behavior. But instead, by trying to live a virtuous life, maybe I could use different words to express my frustration about something, then it contains it much more so. I don't know, do any of you ever have that problem where you've sort of lost control of something just a little bit? It's leaked out a little bit? So living a virtuous life, trying to follow the Eightfold Path, trying to start developing compassion for other people instead of feeding our ego. This has so many tiers. It's a really big, nice, open-ended question. Thank you. It just has so many levels to this. So not only karmically have I kind of disrupted those near me, but also it's disturbed me deep inside. So that just has to do with my behavior. But let's talk about livelihood. Well, if you work in a job where you're injuring others, that would be very upsetting. But maybe at this point, we don't have a choice with that. So we make the aspiration. Aspirations are a big thing in Buddhism. We aspire, maybe someday I don't have to do this. I remember in the early days, we used to have people that had jobs where maybe they were really compromised. Is there a specific one you were thinking about? Yeah.
I don't hear enough about the path, and so I thought this seemed like an opportunity.
Yeah. It's true. It's something I don't think much about, and it's one of the core teachings of the Buddha. Can anyone say them to me? Right livelihood, right action.
Right intention, right effort, right speech.
So they're everything. So they're very close to what?
I've got them for you. I carry this around. It's good stuff. So the first one's right view. You could call that harmonious perspective.
Right. The view, yeah, and that one's fairly deep, so we can keep going.
And I'll interject here in terms of your question. Something Kempo Kartha Rinpoche shared with us a long time ago. He came to teach a Mahamudra text called Eliminating the Darkness of Ignorance. And he was talking about conduct. And he referred to conduct as the path of improvement.
Oh, I like that.
So what happens is the first one, right view, that's what you get from meditation. You realize that everything's interdependent, and what you think, do, and say matters.
Yeah.
So now you've had that realization, and we all get angry or whatever and screw up. So when we see that coming, we have a chance to improve because we've got that realization, okay? So understanding right view first helps you be on the path of improvement because you know that you're not acting consistent with the way you see things.
Yep.
The second is right thought. Then there's right speech, which you talked about. Right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and then right meditation or right concentration. Those are the Eightfold Path. And that's like a whole year's worth of teachings can be made out of.
I think that should be the next class. That would be interesting.
It holds everything in it.
I think right action is a very interesting one. How many times are you rushing off to work and you see somebody that needs help, but you just keep going? You know, you all know I work in a hospital. So I don't care if I haven't clocked in yet. We are trained. I mean, I've been trained at so many hospitals. You help everyone you see if they need your help. And that has really opened my eyes to how selfish I am. Like, I'm supposed to clock in now. Or I don't really want to do that. I don't want to go down half a mile and help them. And so now I love it. It has become my main practice of trying to reach out. And it's made me much more aware of. So I think, and I'm so glad you all, thank you everyone for participating in this. I think it really enriches And shows us where we are. It's a barometer and where we're going. There's this perfect ideal. Shanti Deva is a great place to look at this. I also love Jewel Ornament by Gampopa around sort of tearing apart. Maybe I should say just taking it each step by step. If you ever have a chance in the future, study with Sita Rinpoche. He will take everything apart, almost vowel by vowel, consonant by consonant, and peel it all back to show you how complex and how interrelated absolutely everything is. So, but thank you. That anyway, kind of went off there. Is there one of those people that talks to anyone? And then we'll get to your... Okay, go ahead. What is your question?
Thank you. Whenever we get into conduct, I kind of remember something about why Buddhism appealed to me in the beginning, you know, when I was first exposed to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think maybe without going into, you know, my parents' religion and my childhood, one thing that appealed to me was seemed to be the idea that this virtuous behavior would manifest spontaneously as a result of practice, right?
So, yes.
As opposed to being very hard on myself about all my failings and sort of, you know, getting myself to right behavior as a result of cracking the whip, mm-hmm. either, you mm-hmm. know, myself or my parents when I was young. So I guess I might like to ask you about that. It seems like, of course, we, you know, we have the list of Eightfold Path and the paramitas and so forth.
Right.
So I get it, I think, that it's still good to articulate these things and reinforce them, but isn't the fundamental idea that this stuff, this goodness is inherent and will, as a result of practice, manifest itself
without any effort?
I guess I don't think I mean without effort, but I guess I mean well, that's my question. I guess
it's interesting. You know, there's something I always like to my warning. I have very few warnings about relative and ultimate truth. Ultimately, everything is pure. But relatively, it's not. And so we always have to sort of remember those two things. But I would say, I understand what you're asking, but if you've ever been to a teaching on the Bodhisattva Vow by Rinpoche, where he goes through how from beginningless time what we've done, and the whole room is weeping, we become aware that we do have karma to deal with. And we don't know when that will rise up, and obstacles that could waylay some of that goodness. So that's why we keep trying all the time. And we don't just assume one day we're just going to be. Ultimately, I'd say yes, but relatively, I'd say no. Eric, do you have a comment?
Sure.
Yeah, I know. Oh, we have to watch the time. Go ahead. Of course.
The great generosity of the Buddha and our teachers, the lineage, is that they've shown us a path where we can experience a little bit of the ultimate. And yet, we all have our own idea of reality we haven't let go of yet.
Yeah.
We all have what we like and what we don't like. And by the way, probably no two people in this room agree on what's good and what's bad in terms of, you know, what tastes good and what tastes bad and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So even though we catch a glimpse of it, we are still under the, what shall I say?
Spell.
Yeah, under the spell of karma.
Yeah.
And under the spell of our own ideas, which we each of us are brilliant, we have figured it out, right? Even if we haven't, and we say we haven't, we figured out that we haven't, and we haven't let go.
Yeah, we have this nice bewilderment always going.
Exactly, yeah. Which is the feature of ignorance, which is the ultimate mental poison. So until we're free of that, we're going to be in relative reality, and we shouldn't be arrogant. We should use experiences that arise through karma as a way to improve. That's what conduct's about, so we apply, you know.
I was thinking also of the Four Noble Truths.
And
That where did he go? Everything is suffering. There you are. So, but I think we have to be careful when we think. Effort is a big deal with us. I would talk to Lama Kathy, too. That's a good question for her. I'd love to hear that. Go ahead.
Last week, I was on I was listening to a teaching by a rabbi, and he said something really interesting that I just loved. He said, everybody's got an idea of reality. The problem is, reality is not an idea. I love that, in the sense that all of this, if we experience an obstacle, or if we think it's a misfortune, or even experience a blessing, and it's just we are somehow separate from our own experience, we experience that. Mm-hmm. That's relative reality. When we catch a moment where we're just what they call in the flow, where there's no this and that.
Yeah.
That's a glimpse of ultimate reality. But we just catch glimpses, we don't stay there. So all of this is just an opportunity to stay there a little longer. Maybe instead of 1 millisecond, 2 milliseconds, you know? I think Thich Nhat Hanh said, just improve 1%. That'll take a lot
1%.
Of effort. In 100 years, you'll be fully enlightened.
Yeah.
Or 100 lifetimes, I mean, you'll be fully enlightened. That's good. I mean,
so I think I like, though, that you asked that question, because I think it's a sign that your meditations are going very nicely. Is that true? But keep doing it. Keep evaluating. Thank you, everyone. Go ahead, Tim.
I want to follow up on your introduction of karma into this conversation. For me, it's moment to moment kind of action and result. It's not, I don't think so much about from my lifetime to lifetime kind of karma, but so when I, like when you said, when you get something slips out of your mouth that you sort of wish you hadn't
said.
Could
you stay back just a second, just a teeny bit so I can hear you better? Yeah, thank you.
Sorry.
It's the microphone. I interrupted. I'm sorry. You said right. that, yeah. That it
well,
slips
you know,
out
when something
mouth.
Slips out of your mouth that you regret. Well, the karma is right then. I mean, you feel bad.
Yep.
You know, you can feel that negativity rippling through your body. For me, anyway, that's me. When I'm not generous, holy crap! I mean, I regret it for sometimes years.
Yeah.
I mean, it just ripples through.
I'm so glad you brought this up because
it's every moment, you know. For me, it's just I'm making myself feel good or I'm making myself feel bad by how I conduct myself.
You know, there's a wonderful tool we use daily. It's called confession. Confession to the 35 Buddhas. And you were in there, you review these things, and then you just give it up. You can't hold on to that. Just let it go. It is moment to moment. So, and it's called the 35, I know it in Tibetan, but we can make sure you get it, yeah. So it's called the 35, it has two titles, the 35, the Confessions to the 35 Buddhas, and it's a very beautiful prayer. Maybe we should go over that sometime. We review all who the Buddhas are, then we talk about our actions, and then asking for forgiveness, and then you just let it go. And you kind of have to do that because we're not perfect. But constantly we're doing things. But also with your practice comes great joy. It's sort of always a balancing act.
But I think the point I'm trying to get is that when we become really aware of what we're doing and how and the things that come to us and start to see that connection, then we are in control of how we feel if we are conscious of how we act.
Yeah. Thank you. But remember that remedy. It's a lovely remedy. We have all these little tools. And that's a major one most lamas do every day is the 30, but we're all invited to do it. Pumpe Sumpe Do is the Tibetan, but I'll make sure that, look online. I'm sure you can find it. It's beautiful. Beautiful practice. And it's just so encouraging. But you're right. I think also we become very sensitive over time is what happens. We become more hyper aware of all of our actions. I'm sorry. I interrupted Winnie. Hi.
No, I interrupted.
Good to see you.
Same. So there's a great article on Tricycle Magazine, the Noble Eightfold Path by Walpola Sri Rahula. And basically, you'll be happy to know that the Eightfold Path is divided into three sections, and your lecture followed the three sections. Okay. So you already covered it. The first one was ethical conduct, right speech, right action, and right livelihood, and that's pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
The next one was mental discipline, first one was right effort, and that's basically, according in the explanation here, was making a commitment to the spiritual path and virtue, like you're not there yet, but you're committed to it. And then concentration, which is a meditation practice, and then mindfulness, which develops along with your meditation, as you said. The last two ones that fall under the category of wisdom, right thought and right understanding. And they were basically the inner penetration of samsara and nirvana, while everything is perfect and whole, at the same time it's imperfect and we're all not whole, and that everything is interdependent because everything is whole, and what you do to others, you do to yourself. And so those are the deeper understandings that come by following the other sections of the Eightfold Path. So you already covered it.
Thank you. I love it. All right, so it is almost that time. Is there one more? No. Thank you for all your participation. Sometimes it's so quiet, like a morgue here. I love when it's more active. So just to sort of sum up, this prayer is just so rather complete. It really sums up your path of who you connect with, how you get inspired, what practices to do, shamatha and vipassana, which, by the way, you should definitely ask Lama Kathy if you want to learn vipassana. Don't do it from a book. And then lastly, looking at our conduct, which is a reflection of all of those. So for a moment, I just want to remind you that everybody knows what right action is. We're old enough for that. Don't beat yourself up. Realize that you're human, and we're all learning, we're growing all the time. We are affected by our karma a little bit or a lot. We do suffer from bewilderment of not knowing who we truly are or our true nature. But keep studying, practicing. I think that will keep you very inspired, especially as we move forward in this year. And I hope if you were too busy during the holidays that you spend a little time now reflecting on last year. What inspired you? What was your challenge? What would you like to do different this year? And now to open up your arms to this year with open arms and heart, hoping that wonderful things come forward. So let's spend a moment just quietly offering the merit of all of your patience the last 5 weeks, your diligence and practice, your dedication to the Dharma. Not everyone has these opportunities. May they spread so others have the opportunity to study the truth, to understand compassion and love. And we'll rest our minds for a couple of minutes. Thank you, everyone, so much.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.